Hello and welcome to the final episode of the 1913 Lockout podcast series. I'm your host, Moira Murphy. In this episode, we take a critical look at the state of the Irish trade union movement today and explore what needs to be changed. We hear from Kieran Allen on the history of social partnership and Esther Lynch on the legislative framework for Irish trade unions. We ask Derek Keenan what the trade union response has been to Jobbridge and take a look at a form of community unionism as advocated by the Italian Marxist Antonio Gramsci. But first, we speak to Joe Carolan, union organiser with Unite in New Zealand, about his experience organising fast food workers.
So I suppose when Unite was born in New Zealand, a lot of people had been disillusioned with parliamentary left kind of politics, who formed the leadership of Unite there. And they thought that people had to reconnect with the working class and build organisations for workers. And of course, in New Zealand, a lot of the surviving trade unions are in the public sector. Things like the PSA, the teachers, nurses union, things like that, still fairly sizable. But in the private sector, complete wipeout of unions by the Employment Contracts Act 91. New Zealand was one of the shock laboratories for neoliberalism in from 1984 onwards, with both Labour and national governments savaging the working class and basically more or less smashing the union movement in the private sector. So big plants, you know, the union movement either retreated to the public sector or retreated to the big plants, you know, the big engineering works, metal and stuff like that, leaving, like Ireland, you know, hundreds of thousands of unorganised workers prey to 0 hours, destruction of any kind of penal rates, destruction of overtime, destruction of everything, really. And that was where that left decided, well, we need to go out and fight for these people, you know, not the other ones, you know, the people who had no organisation. So I arrived in New Zealand around about 2005, and I heard about Unite, and then at some success, they'd recruited a couple of thousand fast food workers at that stage, casino workers, security guards, hotels. But these were all people who'd been previously more or less unorganized before. And I knew some of the people who were involved in setting it up from previous times to New Zealand, being active. I went, Jesus, this is the business, you know, this is what Connolly and Larkin, Markovich and stuff would be at, you know. And I wrote that to them, you know, you're doing the work, and that got me an interview. That got me, you're hired. And that was a shock too, because in Ireland, a radical would not be hired by a trade union, for fuck's sake, you know. Our partnership has actually destroyed our union movement here. And there's a whole generation of people in Ireland who've never had a chance to lead a strike, recruit workers, do what unions should do, because they were top down, I'd say, controlled by one party state, you know. There's one dominant party that uses the unions as a cash cow. And it's not for the want of anger or a reason in Ireland that generation was lost out, but that they just structurally weren't allowed to rise up. And I think we're actually paying the price for that now. The overhang of partnership here is that this country should be in general strike like Greece, France, Portugal, but we haven't had that training. There isn't that layer of shop stewards and delegates who could lead protests, you know, from below. So I think that is a problem in Ireland, especially in the private sector too. And I notice a kind of a divide and rule here that they encourage, you know, and that the unions, you know, are these public sector workers with pensions and all of that. And we don't think of it in terms of the unorganized, the poor, the people at minimum wage and stuff like that.
So we're here with Esther Lynch, who's the Legal and Social Affairs Officer of the Irish Congress of Trade Unions. We're going to talk about the legislative framework for trade unions in Ireland. As you know, 1913 Unfinished Business is focused on the centenary of the lockout and its contemporary relevances. In 1913, workers in Dublin struggled for the right to organise, to join and be represented by trade unions without discrimination. A century later, where do we stand on the right to organise in the Republic?
Well, there are a lot of similarities because in 1913, an employer decided, well, I don't mind if we get together, but I don't want you being in that union. And he undertook a series of actions against the people who decided that that's the union that they wanted to be in. And today, there's no real legal protection that stops an employer picking and choosing for the workforce, whether they be represented by a union and which union they be represented by. And so, unlike most other European countries who during the past 100 years have introduced laws to say that, well, actually it's the employee's choice who represents them for collective bargaining, in line with the UN Declaration on Human Rights, in line with the European Convention on Human Rights, that it is the employee's choice who represents them for collective bargaining. The outrageous situation that we have still in Ireland is that the employer gets to choose who represents you for purposes of collective bargaining, so much so they can even choose that it's the head of human resources that represents you. So there's still a lot of unfinished business for workers and their unions when it comes to who's going to represent you for discussions on your pay, your conditions, your hours of work, whether what your start times are, where you'll work, what type of work you'll be doing. And that really does need to be properly recognised as a human right. And the human right is that it's the worker who makes the choice, not the employer.
So first was quite a lot of visiting to these stores. So because we had the law changes, which allows us access, we wrote letters to them going, we would like to arrange access to your places so we can talk to workers about joining the union, which is the law. And they go, oh, shit. And they try to stonewall you a wee bit and a little bit of to and fro. But in the end, they have to arrange access. So then you set up a table or you get a table and, you know, we've improved some of these things. And send the workers out to us one by one, 5 to 10 minutes to each worker. And you talk to the worker for 5 minutes and it's up to you to explain what a union is in 5 minutes, you know. Do you think you're worth more? Are you being bullied here? Are you getting your breaks? You know, have you had a pay rise since you, how long have you been here? 6 years, you know? Oh, is it only the ones with the green eyes that get the promotion? Oh, that's strange, isn't it? You know, are you a migrant worker? You know, how do you think Indian people are being treated here? Oh, you all do the cleaning and the bins, is it? And you're not in the front counter. So you just have a rapport, and it's up to you in that 5 minutes to see where you go. But you build bridgeheads everywhere. So even, you know, like a new franchisee, say like Carl's Jr., bang, one visit, 10 union members, right? Then you get to get them to see who do you think would be a good delegate, you know, is Seamus good or what do you think about, you know, Margaret? And, you know, and so sometimes we shoulder tap, but we try to encourage delegates to come through, you know, the people themselves, they'll all tell you, you know, who they think would be good. Then get those people to a training day, to the workers' councils on a quarterly. And I think this is kind of some of the work that I've been doing this phase around. The first campaigns we ran was just pure energy, you know. Like no one had unionised fast foods before. And it was just like all the energy we had from the anti-capitalist movement or anti-globalisation movement. Just bang, you know, it's like this anti-corporate, now fuck the company kind of thing. And loads of workers really enjoyed that time around, you know, like Starbucks workers like Nick just taking off his green apron and throwing it down and burning it, you know. And you can do that stuff, you know, and that's good. But to sustain the union, you need leadership from people who care about other workers, you know. Like when I'd come to this stuff, I was like in the anti-capitalist movement and was like, you know, used to doing other things to McDonald's, you know, other than so it was very interesting to actually go into these workplaces and talk to the workers who are being exploited in there and then find a mechanism to recruit them, because they're not idiots either. They know all about the big bad corporation, you know. But so this time around, there's less of that kind of anti-capitalist, you know, mood in general society. And this time we've put a lot more emphasis on building delegate leadership on these people, you know, not just all the activists from the outside leading and winning that way. But the workers themselves forming their networks, organising the strikes, knowing the law, standing up to the police, you know, leading their campaign too. So that's kind of been a good thing, because there was such a turnover of people. These industries churn, you know, like there's people going through this like huge turnover. However, with the recession now, it's kind of stabilised. Like, people have less jobs, less places to go, less options. So you actually see a bit of a leadership developing of people who are there 2, 3, 5 years, you know. And people have this image of what a fast food worker is. Like, you know, teenager, you know, getting some pocket money, or a student supplementing their income. There's mothers there with children who, if they get their hours cut by 5 or 10 hours, can't feed their kids, you know. There's older people who've been there 20 years in some of these places, you know. So this whole idea of the precariat, you know, I mean, no, these are workers who need to have secure hours and secure income. And that's been a very good thing about this recent campaign, in the recent phase, is that we actually now feel that the union has its own leadership coming from the stores themselves. But I think in Ireland we do need the rights, like, to go and visit workplaces, sit down with workers mano to mano and recruit them there and then on company time. You know, I think that would be a good thing. Like, we have some problems in New Zealand that workers don't have in Ireland. Like, for example, the right to strike in New Zealand is very limited, in that we can only strike for a collective contract or for health and safety issues. There's only two reasons we can go on strike, right? Whereas here in Ireland, technically, you could go on strike because it's Monday. You know what I mean? And you need to balance and all of that. But, you know, you could strike because someone was unfairly dismissed. For example, you know, this union mandate did plenty of that with Dunn Stores. And so there's, like, good and bad things in every country. Do you know what I mean? Certainly those reforms that I mentioned that we got through years ago, you can see how that's useful, and the union movement needs to be demanding things like that in Ireland. Like, we need the right to go down to Supermax, whatever, meet them on company time, sign people up to the union. You know.
What's the situation with regards to right to access in Ireland, and how could we improve it?
So what we're saying is that you would prohibit as an unfair labour practice an employer not giving appropriate facilities. Now, appropriate facilities can be agreed. They can be, you can have notice periods, you know, so that we're not saying that anybody should be able to walk in and wander around. We understand, of course, about company state secrets, company secrets, and we understand, of course, about health and safety and the importance of that. But at the same time, good faith in the collective bargaining process requires employers to give the union information to say, you know, well, this is the situation, and it requires the union to be given access to workers to discuss, well, here's what collective bargaining would mean in this workplace over the coming year. Here's the type of things that we'd be putting on the agenda. Here's what we're managing to negotiate in other comparable sectors with other comparable categories of workers.
One of the ways the government has dealt with the unemployment crisis has been the creation of the free labour internship scheme known as JobBridge. A recent Indicon report indicated that employers wanted to have the duration of the internships extended to a 12 to 15 month period. Derek Keenan of the CW Youth Committee has been campaigning on this issue. I ask him if he thinks there is a danger that this kind of free labour scheme could become compulsory in the future.
This is probably the only one arm of the job strategy which they are pointing to as being a success. It's probably the only thing they have that they can say is a success. So that's the real danger with JobBridge, because it is being presented. It started off very small. They're preparing the groundwork for this, I feel, to be massively expanded. And how they're going to do this is by pointing to the small numbers that have been in it and saying it's been a success. But the figures don't stack up. They really don't. I definitely think that will be the next step. I mean, if we see a protracted unemployment crisis, which we will, that is going to be the next logical step. They're going to say, in 5 years' time, right, we still have a bad unemployment problem. a shift in the emphasis away from the structural crisis, the structural problems of capitalism, back onto the individual. They're going to say, right, well, people are taking up these schemes, maybe we'll make it compulsory. That's exactly where it's going. I have no doubt about that. At the moment where the trade union movement is, they passed a motion at Congress. In essence, it came from the CWU. Our U committee kind of pushed it on our, well, put it to our union, and to their credit, they took up the issue and they ran with it. Now, it's not the motion wasn't exactly what we would have wanted, but from their contacts with other unions, they knew they'd get support on this if it was phrased in a certain way, and they did get support on it. Basically, it's calling for more oversight, trade union involvement within the steering group of the Jobbridge internship scheme. Because currently, at the moment, there is no trade union representative. The chairperson is the chair of Hewlett-Packard Ireland, and you know that says it all. And of course, he's a keen advocate of free labour scheme. Why wouldn't he be? It's so advantageous to him and his friends. But in saying that, I really think, I mean, I had this discussion with a senior trade unionist who talked about, you know, there's a culture, there's a new culture where younger people aren't seeing a problem with this. And, you know, I took issue with that. I say, well, that's maybe from a small section of our young, maybe the most vociferous, the ones whose parents would be kicking up the most fuss, the strongly middle class, the solidly middle class from the professional backgrounds, maybe that's, as I said, that's not going to be a problem to these people, you know. But I don't think trade union policy, I don't think it's good for trade union policy to be dictated by an attempt to appease this in some sort of way. They need to be looking at the bigger picture of who they're representing. They're representing working class people. That's who you should be thinking of in this. And that's who it disproportionately affects. In terms of where this is going to go, I mean, we're really going to have to see a strong trade union response when the youth guarantee is rolled out, because as we've discussed, that will envisage a huge rollout of the scheme, because there is nothing else. They have nothing else. They're not going to invest in state-led employment. They have an ideological aversion to that, and Jobbridge is the only thing that they have, the only thing they can hold up and say this is a success. It clearly is not. At the outset, you have to say there is a huge disconnect between the trade union movement and unemployed people. The unemployed people should feel let down by the trade union movement, but they don't. And why they feel the let down, because they never felt that they were in any way articulating their vision or that they were fighting for them. And that's something that's developed over the years of social partnership. I mean, they don't feel let down because they don't really have a recognition of trade unions. They don't understand trade unions. They've never known them, good, bad, or indifferent. So that's a huge problem. We need to be getting back out in the communities. And this is an issue, particularly around the youth guarantee, particularly around the fact that young people under 25 are on reduced rates of social welfare payments. I mean, that's something that no political party or the trade union hasn't taken up in a serious way. But I think that is something that we will be pushing for in the future. And I think that's way we engage with young people. Say we're not just about sectoral interests. We have a broader perspective. If we want to get back to being a social movement and people taking it seriously and be able to implement the kind of policies that help working people, irrespective of they're in trade unions now, but they are the future trade unions. Young people are the future trade unions. If we can't connect with them now, the trade union movement is in a very poor state in the future.
Kieran Allen, SIP2 shop steward in UCD and member of the Socialist Workers' Party, explains the history of social partnership and the effects it has on Irish trade unionism today.
Social partnership began in 1987. Significantly, it was inaugurated by Charles Haughey. The first programme of social partnership was known as the Programme for National Recovery, which coincidentally was the title of the Fianna Fáil election programme around that period as well. And that really tells you a lot about it. It was essentially a backroom deal done between the union leaders, who claim that after the defeat of the miners' strike in Britain, they had no other option but to get on the inside track and form an alliance with a sort of economic type alliance rather than a political alliance with Fianna Fáil in order to ward off the threat of the new right. That was the prediction. Okay, well, we look now what more than 30 years afterwards, what do we see? Well, first of all, politics in Ireland have become even more extreme new right than they were in 2007. Union membership has, union density rather, has declined from around 55% of the workforce to 32-33% of the workforce. But even that disguises the fact that there are less manual workers in unions now than there were in the past, less younger workers than in the past, very low rate of unionisation amongst migrant workers. So essentially you've had a big decline in union density over the partnership years. In terms of where how workers have done, well, again, you can look at just the bald figures. In 1987, the share of the Irish economy going to wages, pensions and social welfare was around 50%. Today it has declined to about a third of the Irish economy. There's been an enormous transfer of wealth from labour to capital in that period. At the time when Connolly and Larkin were fighting, there wasn't a union bureaucracy. There was, if you like, quite brave people who went into battle. They didn't have many privileges beyond those that their workers got. Connolly said at around 1911, 1912, I think, he said that no contract with the boss class obligates workers to stand aside when another group of workers has been attacked by that boss class. In other words, it's not the contracts with the employers that count, it's solidarity with working class people. Now, when we move the movie on, Sean O'Casey said of William O'Brien, who really is the figure who probably shaped the Irish Transport, later SIPTU, that he was the archetypal bureaucrat. He was like a little clerk counting his pennies. His primary interest was in essentially building up the union apparatus, getting rid of elections for full-time officials, essentially establishing the idea of being a full-time official as a career. And the problem of establishing the idea of being a full-time official as a career and having more wages than the workers you represent is that, as Sydney and Beatrice Webb pointed out many, many years ago, you forget what it means for the workers you represent, the suffering. You forget all of this. So, you know, you can be union official. You can go in and negotiate a productivity deal that your members work harder, as indeed they have with this Croke Park agreement. But you don't have to work it yourself. And therefore you get this gap between a union bureaucracy and a union membership. That union bureaucracy, historically in Ireland, has always tried to get close to the Irish state. It's formed an unofficial alliance with Fianna Fáil in the 1940s. Still has, well, still up, and certainly in the time of Haughey, still has a similar alliance. And it has broadly sort of a right-wing social democratic outlook. So when it comes to the crisis, I mean, and you have this type of union leadership formed over decades facing a situation of the worst crisis of Irish capitalism, I mean, they knew very well that to resist wage cuts would have meant unleashing an enormous struggle, a really struggle that could have got out of hand. And therefore, they took the alternative view. They were not going to actually fight. What we're going to do is try to reassert social partnership. But the price has been wage cuts, divisions inside the union movement, and so on. Are there any signs of hope? I mean, unions are quite difficult to understand often for people who are not engaged in unions. And I've seen certainly people in the Anti-Household Charges campaign being quite hostile to unions, identifying the union bureaucracy with the union as such. I would say something different. I would say that at the base of the union, there is a profound anger at what the union leaders are doing. There is also a lack of confidence. And that the union leaders leech off that lack of confidence to encourage more passivity. But on the other hand, we've seen, for example, in SIPTU, the formation of the SIPTU grassroots. There's a major campaign underway in SIPTU at the moment to disaffiliate from the Labour Party. Thousands of workers have put in forms not to have any of their union dues go to the Labour Party. If there was an election in the morning for the SIPTA leadership, I have no doubt that a rank-and-file candidate would do extremely well, and possibly even win. But of course, SIPTA leaders, knowing this, have abolished elections by the general membership for national officers. We're talking about, really, a very undemocratic structure, a crust inside SIPTA composed of a few hundred hacks, hangers-on of the officials, dominating the union machine. But below that, at workplace level, there are many fine, decent trade union people who, as I say, would like a fight, would like to see a decent leadership, but don't quite know yet how to bring that about.
Antonio Gramsci was an Italian Marxist writer and philosopher from the early 20th century. He is best known for his theory of cultural hegemony, a way of describing how the ruling class dominates a diverse society by manipulating its culture to fit their view of the world. In 1919, 7 years before he was imprisoned by Mussolini's fascist government, he wrote a text on workers' councils and workers' democracy in Italy. In it, he expanded on what he saw as the need to complement working class organization in the workplace, under factory councils, with ward committees based in the communities where workers lived. While the factory councils might have a good idea of the conditions of workers in one sector, they didn't offer a perspective or a way to organise the class as a whole. If where workers live is a class base as much as where they work, why omit this from organisation? Gramsci hoped that factory councils would develop from bargaining and limiting the power of capitalists to replacing them with workers running the factories. He wrote that the aim should be to get one delegate elected for every 15 workers, divided into categories, arriving by electoral stages at a committee of factory delegates which included representatives of the whole work process, manual workers, clerical workers, technicians. The ward committee would include delegates from all categories of workers living in the ward, servants, coachmen, tram drivers, railway workers, road sweepers, private employees, clerks and others. What Gramsci was arguing for, in effect, was community unionism. And his proposals have important ramifications for today. If we consider the many parts of the working class that remains outside the trade unions and how difficult it is to organise certain types of work, such as domestic work, into those structures, ward committees provide a way to make sure that institutions are created that can build workers' power not just outside workplaces, but on a basis that includes the entire class. Today, organisation in our localities tends to fall under the title of community development. Programmes often led from above and that rarely enable workers to really take democratic control of the places they live. But if we follow Gramsci's suggestion, we can see that an alternative possibility, where structures are built from below in both workplaces and communities that allow for workers to take democratic control of the society which their work creates and runs.
As we come to the end of the Unfinished Business Lockout podcast series, why did we decide at the start to do a podcast series on the labour movement?
Well, I suppose initially we had these discussions before 2013 and it came from a kind of deliberate desire to reintroduce class politics into discourse, but also in terms of organising. Because I suppose we were looking around at the time, 5 years into recession, the movements, the social movements, and the way that people were articulating the problems that existed in Irish society and in relation to austerity in particular, did not seem to have any kind of systemic understanding of capitalism and the struggle between capital and labour. So that was kind of the broader problem that we saw. I think as well, my own experience with the Occupy movement, the Occupy movement itself was quite hostile to any kind of trade union involvement, but also it would seem that people didn't really seem to understand or have any engagement with the trade union movement in the first place. So this presented itself as a kind of an obvious problem and wasn't something that was really addressed in any of the existing kind of campaigns or movements, certainly nothing that I'd been involved in. But I suppose then we kind of all came to that collective agreement then that this was something to really kind of hold on to for 2013. Obviously, knowing that there was going to be all these kind of commemorations around 1913 and the lockout itself being explicitly about, you know, class politics and the antagonism between labour and capital. So I suppose we kind of knew all that stuff was going to happen. So it's just finding a way, pose the question and bring up those issues in a genuine way that could actually draw on some kind of existing understanding, historical memory or whatever, of those events, but also then making it relevant. The level of depoliticization is enormous, and people don't really talk about class at all. They don't talk about working class, and they don't talk about capital, they don't talk about the struggles going on between that. And that is inherent in what trade unionism is, or how it functions, and the whole reason it exists. You know, if you can't have that very basic discussion or understanding, well, you're not going to get very far. So that is the obvious starting point for 2013 and what we're trying to do.
It brings us into the question of why unions are relevant today. I think for a lot of people, since the start of this recession, when you've heard about trade unions, you've heard about anti-union rhetoric coming from the mainstream media and the two largest right-wing political parties in this country. We have the flows of information people get that have a huge impact on how they see society are controlled by people who don't want to see working class institutions that are strong, who don't want to see workers empowered. What austerity has shown us more than anything else is that there is a fundamental division in society between labour and capital, between workers and capitalists. And what austerity has tried to do is to take a crisis that was ideologically and practically the making of the rich and to resolve it on the backs of workers. And we have to ask then, how can we fight back against this? And that brings us to the genesis of the trade union movement. The trade unions are the institutions of one side of that class conflict in society. They are historically the workers' institutions. There are lots of problems with the trade unions we have right now. But if we're looking to fight back, and our only strength is in collective action, the only strength that we have is that we're many and they're few. They have the wealth in society. They have the tools in terms of the media, in terms of the political system, to control society as it is. But what they don't have is the majority of people whose interests they serve. And that's where the question of trade unions in 2013 comes up.
I suppose kind of social partnership has been a massive issue. It's essentially de-trained, de-armed a whole generation of trade unionists, some trade union officials, people our age. We don't really remember anything but industrial peace. So we're kind of starting from, you know, very basic steps as well. I can remember a teacher strike in 2001, but I can't really remember all too many struggles. So when social partnership comes in, it's nearly like a sign of like weak confidence within the unions, because what social partnership does is the servicing model, the officials kind of step in and substitute themselves and intermediate the struggle between the workers and the bosses. So when the workers don't have the confidence, maybe the experience or the ability to or maybe they've been defeated, it can happen. The lockout was defeated. We haven't really seen any struggles, so we've just had, rights being chipped away, traditions being chipped away, the kind of the culture, the instinct to kind of resist and fight back and take action and struggle. They're nearly alien concepts for a lot of people, a lot of trade unionists. So that's kind of brings us up to where we are today. Like Kieran Allen was saying earlier in his piece, that when we're coming into this crisis, the employers have been exceedingly organized, exceedingly well organized, and they have known what to do. The employers, never stepped back and said, "Oh, what's the sensible thing to do here?" They just went straight for the throat. They went straight for the jugular. And we've been absolutely hit so hard by their attack. And instinctively, you think, well, where's the counterattack?
Just going back to what Moira said at the start about reinvigorating class politics and that being one of the tasks of 1913 Unfinished Business, one of the other effects of social partnership, this constant intermediating body, bureaucratic layer between workers and bosses, is it robs us of the energy that is going to be necessary to create a fighting and winning labour movement, And that energy comes from class consciousness. Class consciousness is developed through conflict. Now, if people were to go in any workplace in Ireland and sit down with a piece of paper and put your boss on one side and the workers on the other and ask, what do those two groups want? Your boss wants higher profits and workers want higher wages. Your boss wants less paperwork to do. Workers want better health and safety. The interests of workers and the interests of bosses are in conflict every day of the week. And that is the basis. That awareness is the basis on which you build a labour movement that fights and wins. If you have a trade union body, which rather than being the organic representation, the democratic representation of workers in their workplace, who are aware of the fact that their interests don't fit with the interests of their bosses, if you have a trade union structure that steps in between those two and stops people from ever seeing the conflict, ever talking about the conflict, ever been able to organise on the basis of that conflict, well, then you're never going to have the energy which class consciousness provides.
Well, yeah, there's an issue as well, like as kind of an abstract sense, as the economy kind of moves on and some industries go down and new industries kind of emerge, that where people maybe used to have been organised, say in old industries, maybe best example might be like mining in the UK. And maybe today the equivalent might be the public sector, actually. The unions like throw their lot in with the public sector, who is like the easiest fight for them in a bit of a way, because there are certain collective bargaining rights within there, and there's people who have rights and they're willing to be a member to keep up those rights. But there's a shift then, like as time moves on, especially over the last 30 years since Thatcher and Reagan and all that, that the size of the state and the public sector has shrunk and shrunk and shrunk. And the focus of unions, naturally in a sense, has been to protect their members. So naturally the focus of unions has been to protect their existing members, largely in the public sector. So as time kind of moves on and you go through all the different frames and the private sector gets bigger and bigger, but the amount of people who are organised within that is smaller and smaller and smaller. So overall, I think, I remember in the Irish Times, I think the SIP2 membership fell 10% in 2011-2012. A lot of that will be people retiring, people leaving the workforce. It's an age, the average age of people in trade unions is actually quite old. And not to be ageist about it, they're very valuable. But that means they're not being replaced by people coming up. I think there was a survey that said the trade union density of people under 35 was, correct me if I'm wrong, something like 9%. So if you kind of take that and kind of move, progress it on, a decade, what's the trade union density going to be? It could be absolutely minuscule and tiny, because the offensive on the state and the public sector is only intensifying. So where is that going to leave unions in a few years? That's why it's imperative that they are opened up, that they do kind of shift focus or add to their focus to organise the unorganised, organise people in the private sector. Like I don't really know many people who work in the public sector, because there have been embargoes on teachers and guards and all sorts. Most people who stay in the country end up working in hospitality, end up working in retail, end up working in hotels. So they're not places where you traditionally see a massive union presence, massive worker struggles. They're very isolated. They might be on 0-hour contracts. Mm. It's just a completely, atomized workplace, like you might have targets, and if you don't make those targets, boom, you're gone. So it makes it very, very difficult for people to organize.
If we're to be serious about being a movement of workers, we got to get into the private sector. It's harder than it is in the public sector.
Mm.
But those hard battles have to be fought. And it also is going to bring the trade union movement much more in touch with where the future work is going. Future work is not what we would call union jobs in the public sector. The future work is a 0-hour contract in Aldi. The future of work is working as a bar staffer and being told that your hours are cut to nothing the week after you say you're going to join a trade union. That's the future of work. And if the trade union movement doesn't adapt to that, if the skill set isn't built up to organise around that, well, then it's going the way of the dodo. And this is why it's important, not just for people inside the union movement, but if you're a worker, you got to ask yourself, what then? What comes up and replaces the organisation that represents you in your workplace, the place where people spend huge majority of their lives, the place where people earn their livings? There is no replacement.
Mm-hmm.
And the reality is, if the trade union movement goes down, people who are workers, who are on our side of this class battle, go down with it.
I think one of the great things that came out of this podcast was what Joe Carlin was saying and the experience he was talking of in New Zealand organising the fast food workers. Just actually having that structure, having the right of access as a mechanism to engage and speak to workers in a meaningful way and directly to their face, you know, explain to them what the benefits are of joining a union, and then actually in practice winning real gain, you know, making real gains for the working class, for the people in those jobs, and being able to say that, being able to say, well, we won X amount of wage increase here, we got this, you know, whatever discrimination case, whatever it was there, just being able to see that as a way of actually building, and that's certainly a model that would be very interesting to bring over here. Obviously then we've learned that there are issues around that in Ireland. We don't have the right of access, and I think that in particular would make a significant difference in terms of how we could organize. And I think, you know, that's kind of, that could be easily brushed over as just kind of some kind of difference in legislation or whatever, but actually what it would allow for is something really significant, a genuine, you know, engagement with workers in their workplace. And with the time to actually develop relationships and trust, and something we don't really have here in the for the private sector specifically is important.
Take trade unionism back to the streets. Our trade unions play too much chess. We need to play more hurling.
Lovely.
Well, the point is that if trade unions become negotiations by people in suits in boardrooms, we lose. If trade unions become workers organising their workplace, striking and winning, that means the labour movement has a future. They're the two paths. They're the choices we've got to make.
I suppose one of the reasons why, you know, we've done this, what inspired us kind of to do this, is being the centenary of the 1913 lockout. In our fifth podcast, we talked about new unionism. And as Ronan was kind of saying earlier on, do we have workers' institutions or do we have a workers' movement? So kind of new unionism was the birth, I suppose, of the modern trade unionism that we have. You know, one big union, one man, one vote, or one person, one vote. And it started in 1889 in the London dock workers' strike. And you had involved all sorts of migrant workers who, you know, if whatever rights that were there, you know, they had less than everyone else. You had different jobs, different sectors on the dock. So it was like a localized general strike. And it was a living movement where people went in and organized. People threw themselves into it. And that's began a wave that, you know, spread from England to France to America with the Wobblies and Big Bill Haywood, Elizabeth Gurley Flynn, Mother Jones, James Larkin, James Connolly, and then taken back to the UK from, you know, Liverpool and then into Ireland and then from Cork. Wexford and then up to Galway and Sligo and Belfast, 1907, crossing the sectarian lines, and then down into Dublin again. So it was a living, breathing movement, and that's what created the institutions that we have. So it's a movement that rejuvenates and keeps our institutions alive. So if we don't get a movement from below, well, then the future for institutions is uncertain, and it's going one way. So this begs the question, as we finished on the first podcast, do we have unfinished business?
That's all for this final episode in the 1913 Unfinished Business podcast series. Thanks for listening. If you would like to get in touch or be updated on future events, email us at ub1913@gmail.com or visit our website ub1913.wordpress.com. Contributors for this week's show were Moira Murphy, Ronan Burtonshaw, Jen O'Leary, Shane Fitzgerald, Owen Griffin, and Padraig Madden. Thanks to Joe Carolyn, Esther Lynch, Derek Keenan, and Kieran Allen. Produced by Moira Murphy.